Thanks for joining us on Streamlines, your source for water knowledge. I'm your host, John McMain, with South Dakota State University Extension. This is Episode 2. Welcome back, everyone. I'm John McMain.
And I'm Anthony Bly.
And last week, we introduced you all to conservation drainage, the different practices, and some of the pros and cons of tile drainage in general, because it's important to start at that point to talk about conservation drainage. So today, we're going to continue the discussion and dive into other barriers keeping folks from implementing conservation drainage practices, and then how we can work to overcome these barriers. Something I'm really excited about in all of these episodes we're doing, the future of conservation drainage. What does that look like? What's the forward look? What do we get excited about for the future? And so last episode, we introduced Chris Hay and Yaba Kjærsgaard, leading researchers in the field of conservation drainage, and do a lot of application as well. We'll hear from them again today. We'll hear what Chris has to say about what he believes are the barriers that are keeping farmers from implementing conservation drainage practices.
Those edge of field conservation drainage practices, probably the biggest one is economics, with the possible exception of controlled drainage, where again, you can get a little crop benefit from that, from managing the water, and similarly with drainage water recycling, although the total economic picture of that is still something we need to figure out. For the most part, those edge of field practices, it's purely a downstream water quality benefit. There's no real benefit back to the farmer or landowner. And so, you know, even at 100% cost share, you know, there's time and effort and management involved, and potentially you may have to give up a little land, put that practice in. And so there's not a lot of incentive economically to put those practices in. And so it does take someone that's willing to do it despite not having a real incentive economically to do so. They've got higher upfront costs than say, cover crops or infield management. They're still kind of unfamiliar, so there's more technical assistance needs around these practices. You need to have the funding in place to be able to implement these practices, again, with kind of the higher upfront costs. Then again, there's a lot of time and friction to work through the process to actually implement these edge of field practices.
Did that ring true to you, Anthony?
Oh, that's 100% true.
That struck home.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's something that I have never really thought about is, even if this is a 100% free, you know, like 100% cost share, there's still the resources of your time and effort and, you know, worry or not worry, but like mental energy that's being expended to think about this practice, how it's going in, how to manage it, how to operate it.
There's a lot involved, and if there's no really good incentive, I can see that being a big barrier, huge barrier.
Yeah. So I don't really know how to get around that unless we, I don't know. What do you think? Is there any way we can get around that?
Well, there's got to be some type of environmental credit or something like that that can be gained or earned or something in exchange for something else. I don't know that it has to be dollars exchange. That can we devise a credit system?
So even if it doesn't cost money to put it in, there's no direct benefit, and there is a direct cost because you're still expending time and energy and
absolutely
management
space
and space. Yep, and time is, man, it is a real premium for a farmer
because you can use your time somewhere else and make money.
This is true. So there is an opportunity cost of putting something in, both in the space and in the time, because otherwise you could use that space and or time to do something else that is a net positive.
Correct. It's a big issue with farmers because they're looking at bottom line every day and returns. And the question is for them, why would we do this?
Yeah. Just because it's free doesn't mean it's a good investment.
Yeah, in some cases it isn't even free. You know, it's cost share. It's
right.
Part of it. Yeah. So
maybe 40% or 60% or
correct.
Yeah.
Yep. So I think there needs to be some level of certification or credit or recognition or from society that agriculture is, you know, motivated to do their part.
Yeah. So I want to ask you about the certification idea. How much value do you think could be gained from being a, you know, certified clean water farm or something like that? If you had some type of certification like that, how valuable would that be to a farmer?
Well, I think right now farms are being certified as far as their sustainability, maybe that's not the right word, or carbon footprint. And I think that should all be tied together with the environment. And so farms that become certified or become in this group, you know, they may receive higher prices for what they produce in the marketplace because consumers want that identified with their end products.
Right. So even if it's not a direct credit for some type of practice implementation, you're still getting a premium because of the value of your management system.
Correct. Yep. It could be tied to bioenergy. It could be tied to, you know, anything.
Yeah, makes sense.
And I think it's where society can pay it through the products, carbon-free crackers or biofuels that are low carbon and certified as low carbon. And so the consumer knows that something is going on to protect the environment.
And I've seen the argument mainly on Twitter, so, you know, take it with a grain of salt, I guess, but there's a perception that folks may not be willing to pay more for foods. Like, there might not be the demand for food perceived, but I think the reality is you would find a significant market. I mean, I think we see that with organic. I mean, people are willing to pay more for organic. Some people, like,
absolutely.
It's not all the way across the spectrum, but figuring out what the demand in the market is could then drive incentive to put in more
conservation practices.
More conservation practices. Mm-hmm. Love it. So I'm an engineer by training and sometimes thought process, and Yaba is an engineer. And so one of the things I asked Yaba was, what does he see as, I said the Tesla of conservation drainage, but basically what is kind of going to be the next big shift in the market that's really going to drive a lot of innovation and that type of thing?
I think for conservation drainage practices, it is moving towards a higher degree of automatization. And I think we need that because we all know, when we're out on the farm, you get busy and you might not have time to do the maintenance or make adjustments as some of these practices might require. And so a higher level of automating how the practices work, but still keeping them very cost effective, I think is the direction that we're moving.
As an engineer, I love to hear that.
Sure you do.
Because that's something that I can get behind and I understand. What do you think about automation? What do you see as the potential for that?
Oh, I think it's definitely there. You know, people really like all of the precision farming, you know, tools, the row control. Of course, the yield map started it all off, but the steering, the accuracy of those, some of those things are getting really good. You know, we're controlling them with our smartphones. I think automation would fit right in if, you know, makes sense economically, and it has to be probably at the top of the list.
There's still an ROI, even if it is invested for agronomic profitability. It still has to return on that investment.
Correct.
Yeah, and the thing about automation that excites me is we are getting to the point where we have access to so much data. So we can get soil moisture data, we can get weather data, we can get evapotranspiration data. The Mesonet in South Dakota is expanding, will be up to 150 stations in the next 5 years or so. So we have access to all this data, but an individual taking that data, making a decision, you know, like a once a month decision, that really doesn't shift the paradigm much. It doesn't move the needle. But if we're able to pull all this data together, run it through a machine learning algorithm to say what's the best way we can manage the water, and then automatically managing that water, now I think that does move the needle, and we get real, concrete, quantifiable improvements in how we manage water. And then the result of that would be improvements to water quality downstream, improvements to nutrient use efficiency, improvements to crop yield, and improvements to profitability. So automation and kind of this next phase is really exciting to me as well.
Oh, yeah. I think it could be big.
And it fits with precision agriculture. SDSU, we're all about precision agriculture. So, yeah, I think the future is bright for conservation drainage. So Chris works for Iowa Soybean Association. So it's a little bit different perspective than, you know, just a university researcher or an agency researcher. And so I wanted to get Chris's take on what some of the innovative projects they're working on, kind of what his interaction has been with farmers and others in the conservation drainage field. So this is just kind of an overview of some of the ways that he and his organization are working to advance conservation drainage.
I think some of the things that Iowa Soybean has been pretty innovative, or at least early to the table on. We've really focused a lot on water monitoring. And so we've got our own water monitoring, water quality lab here at Iowa Soybean. We started with some early stream monitoring to get an idea of targeting, where it is we wanted to work, where we could have the most benefit. And as we did that, you started to see some areas that needed some help or needed some targeting. But at that scale, you really can't tell exactly which fields or which smaller areas are really contributing to that. So we started to move to drainage districts, and then even those drainage districts, there's a lot of operations within those drainage districts. And so eventually worked our way down to monitoring individual drainage outlets. And so once you get to that level, then it's less abstract for the farmers that you're working with. It's their outlet. They can see exactly what their management means as far as nutrient loss out of their operations. The economic loss of that nitrogen leaving the system, but also understand the water quality impacts. It makes it a little easier to have that conversation about ways to try and minimize that loss. So I think water monitoring has been a big one to further that conversation. We've also been very big on watershed planning, getting farmers together within the watershed so that they really take ownership of trying to meet water quality goals for their watershed collectively. One of the other things we've more recently started doing is this idea of conservation agronomists. Long realized that the ag retailer network is key in trying to make a lot of this happen. Most of the surveys will show that those ag retailers that they work with are some of the people they trust the most. So, if we can engage that ag retailer network, that's a way to try and implement more conservation. But there's some challenges in trying to do that because they don't want to take on any risk that might risk their relationship with those farmers and especially their sales. Come up with this idea of conservation agronomist, someone that we either embed in an ag retailer, it could be a specific ag retailer, it could be that they're up in a watershed area and working with the different ag retailers that service that area. But they come from an ag retail background or sales agronomist background and have that agronomy background, but then also understand the conservation practices. They can develop relationships with those ag retailers, and then that's a foot into the door to try and build on those relationships that the ag retailers have with those farmers. And so then they can have the conservation conversation, and the ag retailer can maintain their relationship with the farmers.
So what do you think about that, Anthony?
That's an interesting concept. I know there's some independent conservation agronomists, that help farmers independently, but teaming them up with ag retailers would be a real interesting concept. Kind of like farm bill biologist,
sure.
In a way. They're not in the retail location, but they're helping farmers with all of those conservation type issues.
Sure.
Programs.
Yep.
Questions. Record keeping, Yeah. Questions.
Yeah, and again, I'm really glad of Chris's perspective being with a commodity group, commodity organization, because it helps me understand that it's a way more complex system than just the science of what's going on, in the practice or in the ground. And the social science, the economics, the relationships, it's such a
trust issues.
Yeah.
Yep.
Trust in each other, trust in organizations, trust in data.
Yep.
Trust in ways we collect data, trust in ways data is used.
And then there's money to be made. Money needs to be made.
Right.
That's the essential part of it, is the money needs to be made somehow, some way.
One thing that I thought was interesting too, that Chris will talk about in a clip here in a second, is these practices don't just happen, right? There needs to be some workforce that goes into designing, installing these practices. So if there's a significant demand, we don't really have the workforce in place to put these practices in.
No, absolutely not.
But then why should there be a workforce if there's no work for them to do, right?
Correct.
So it is a little bit of a chicken and an egg thing right now of we can't put stuff in because we don't have the workforce, but we can't have the workforce because we don't have the work to do yet. So
got to walk before you run.
You got to walk before you run. And so I think that's another aspect as we think about scaling up is what are the different factors preventing us from scaling up? Some of it's science, some of it's education, some of it's training, but then there's things like, yeah, the economics and the workforce, and it's a complex system and there's a lot of moving parts.
I thought Chris's comments about testing was really good.
Yeah. So does that sound like a program that you've heard about in South Dakota?
Yeah. You know, I think it's been tried and attempted and it's not dead, I don't think, but, yeah. I think it's just important to bring awareness. I think producers need to see where they're at. Refer to nitrates in the water, a simple one. It needs to be private, confidential, and
also where they're at in relation to not everyone else, but like what's normal, what's average, you know.
Correct.
Seeing one number that's your own, it's hard to put that in context. But if you can see where you're at relative to 50 other fields, then now you know that, oh, yikes.
Correct.
There's something I need to do about that.
I would like to bring awareness to producers as how much water is actually going down the drainage way or out the outlet of
sure.
the tile.
So the volume.
The volume of water.
Do you think it's more than they suspect? Or
you know, I really don't know. I'd like to get a handle on that myself.
Sure.
And then we can start to think about the potentials for that water, what that means.
Mm-hmm. Viewing it as a resource rather
sure.
than a
yeah.
waste product.
And how it applies to conservation drainage.
So one program that we've started in South Dakota with funding from the Nutrient Research and Education Council is actually a similar setup to what Iowa Soybean is doing and did, but we're monitoring tile, taking weekly or samples every other week, analyzing them for nitrate and orthophosphate with a twofold objective. One is to just set a baseline of what's going on and what's coming out of tile in eastern South Dakota. There's been a fair amount of research across the upper Midwest and, well, across the U.S., but historically in more tiled areas. I mean, tile, while it's not new in South Dakota, you know, we have tile around that's 100 years old, but it's definitely seen a resurgence. And we've seen, I think from 2012 to 2017, there was a 69% increase in acres tiled. So we're seeing a huge amount of growth. And South Dakota is not Iowa. It's not Minnesota. It's not Illinois. We have different soil makeups. We have a different climate. And so getting a handle on what is coming out of tile in eastern South Dakota, I think is important to set a baseline. And then once we know that baseline, like Chris said, we can start identifying risk factors. So are there certain soil types? Is it completely driven by weather? Is it different management? Is it cropping pattern? Well, whatever the case would be. Once we identify risks, then we can optimize implementation of some of these practices.
Yeah, we're dealing with that wet dry line. It moves, and so it's not as consistent as farther east.
Right.
That makes data even more critical.
Absolutely. A nice metaphor. Well, I think it's nice. I don't know if it really is nice, but you know, with any hit song, you have a good bass line, right?
Right.
Think of like Under Pressure. Doom, doom, da doom, da doo doom. You know, you got that baseline.
Yeah.
Everything is centered around that. You build off that baseline.
Correct.
I think the same goes for water quality. Before we can build anything, implement anything, we have to set that baseline.
Mm-hmm.
Where are we at and where do we want to go and then how do we get there?
Same with conservation drainage.
Yeah.
Quantity, when.
Yep.
When does it occur and how much?
Yep. So I agree with Chris. I think monitoring is very important for just the understanding what's going on. And then like you mentioned, Anthony, it's important to kind of raise the profile in the minds of the public, in the minds of farmers of, you know, what's in water, what's the timing, what's the amount, helping individuals get a better handle on what's coming out of their tile. Yeah, so I wanted to dig in a little more with Chris and kind of get the feedback and how the conversation's gone when they introduced the idea of sampling tile.
There's some that just don't want to know or don't care. And that's real. And we see that. But I think probably the majority, you know, has some interest, some curiosity, wanting to know what's leaving out of their outlets. Again, you know, I think part of that's just they're losing nitrogen. They're losing an asset or a benefit. So if they understand that, then they think about ways that might look at management changes to try and limit that. And then again, there's others that are, you know, truly concerned about wanting to positively impact water quality. And so you can't really manage for that unless you know what it is that you're trying to manage for. We do a survey with that annual report that we send back to the farmers. And there was about a third of farmers that said they either had made some changes or were considering making some changes to their practices.
I think that's encouraging.
It means that people are aware and interested in the impact they have and can have and want to do something about it.
I think we need to, you know, try to get across that we don't share that information and that we do everything we can to prevent it from being shared. Of course, there's legal proceedings that could come into play sometime, but we're doing it for the producer.
Yeah, whenever I've introduced folks to the program here in South Dakota, that's how I've talked about it. And yeah, I'm interested from a research and scientific perspective, but I'm interested because of the implications it could have for that producer in a positive way. The more information they have, the more opportunity they have to manage their system in a way that, you know, improves profitability, reduces nutrient loss. That's really the bottom line for that situation, and it gives them an opportunity because of additional information.
I think it's positive all around. If the nitrate levels in their tile are adequate or low, that's good. If they're too high, that's not bad either, because then we can start addressing what we can do to maybe reduce them,
right,
and save that money that you're talking about.
Right.
Knowledge is power.
And lack of knowledge is how...
It's chaos.
It's chaos. If you don't know, then anybody can make an assumption. Like, anybody can say what they want.
Correct.
If there is no data to say otherwise.
Correct.
Okay, so we've done a lot of research on conservation drainage. We've done a lot of research on edge of field practices, infield practices, how they affect nutrient loss. I mean, I'd say we have a ways to go on kind of optimizing systems and developing decision support tools. And so there's a fair amount of research that could be done still. But we're also kind of transitioning into this implementation phase. Like, we've researched, we've demonstrated, now let's get these practices in the ground. Even though these systems are pretty simple and straightforward, you still need some design aspects. You need skilled workers to implement these systems. So we need a workforce that is equipped to be able to put these practices in the ground. So it's a little bit of a chicken and an egg thing. And Chris really said this well, so I'll let him talk about that.
Definitely a chicken and egg thing that, you know, right now, probably the biggest issue is we just don't have enough demand. But, you know, if we create demand, then there's not the supply right there now either. And so it's kind of a balancing act that we need to be able to ramp up the supply, but we also need to know that the demand's going to be there when we're doing that. And so, you know, it's a challenge right now on both fronts to try and increase the demand, but also ensure that the supply is going to be there when the demand does arrive.
So we need the workforce to be able to put the practices in, but we can't really train the workforce if there's no work for them to do.
Correct.
I mean, who's going to get into a job that there's no guarantee they're going to be able to work?
There's
right?
no demand for it.
And so, I mean, that's a challenge. It's probably a challenge with any new industry, honestly. And the other thing about the workforce, and I've seen this in other applications, so in stormwater and managing water in urban areas, but if you take folks that aren't properly trained, then when they implement a system, it may be more likely to fail.
Correct.
An example I'll give is for a rain garden or a bioretention cell. Now, a bioretention cell in urban stormwater that is driven solely by infiltration. A typical contractor, if they were just doing landscaping, they would go in there, they'd drive their equipment through the bioretention cell and, you know,
compact it.
Yeah, exactly. So then you end up compacting the soil. So now this system that's supposed to work by infiltration doesn't work.
It overflows.
And you have this nice, you know, say the city of Sioux Falls put in this nice bioretention cell, contractor didn't do a great job. And it's
a cesspool.
It's a cesspool. And then that's an eyesore. And then that's an example of why we shouldn't put these practices in. And so if we have a workforce that isn't adequately trained, then every practice they put in, say they put in a bioreactor, it has a lot of sediment in there, it clogs within the first year. Well, now that's an example of, yep, bioreactors don't work because they clog. In reality, it was a workforce issue or a training issue. I shouldn't say it's a workforce issue. It's a training issue. And so you need a sufficient workforce to be able to put the practices in. Simultaneously, you need the demand. You need the practices to be able to put in. But then you also need training for the workforce that they can put it in well. So it's a lot of things that kind of need to converge at the same time.
It's complicated.
It's a balancing act, like Chris said. So I asked Chris, what's the future look like? What's the next frontier for conservation drainage? I'll let him talk about that.
I think probably the frontier right now on conservation drainage and Edgefield practices in particular, to me, really resolves around a finance, you know, conservation finance and really market-based solutions that, you know, unless there's a big change in, you know, federal funding and state level funding, you know, we're only going to get so far with cost share on these practices. And so really need to look at other ways that we can finance these practices and address that fact that again, there's real no economic incentive to the farmer or landowner to put these practices in. And I think if we come up with ways that we can put together buyers and sellers of these ecosystem services, and water quality being one of those ecosystem services, then that's a way that those farmers and landowners could actually capture some economic benefit of putting in these practices. I think there is some movement on that. It's still very early days, but the more we can add in some of these market-based solutions, I think that's a way to really scale up implementation of these practices. One of the things that we need to do then to really support that is we need to come up with better ways to both model what the expected outcomes of these practices are, you know, kind of cheaper, easier, more effective ways to be able to monitor and track and verify those outcomes. You know, kind of more the day-to-day, I think, you know, building out some more of these decision support tools. I think there's a lot of work yet on the kind of the technology and the tools to help with implementation of the practices that's probably more short-term right now.
It's all about the money.
It's all about the money. Markets, finance.
Ecosystem services. Chris explained that well.
There's things we can directly measure like yield or treatment cost, but these practices do have real value. It's just really hard to quantify sometimes.
Yeah, and who's going to or who wants to pay for them?
Right. And if you have a system that it's stuck with one buyer and one seller, or one buyer and a lot of sellers of these credits, then that money is not sustainable. You know, his point about federal and state funding decreasing, honestly, I mean, I don't even want to count on cost share from a federal program.
That's just got to be built into our system somehow.
Right. And maybe it is a way that we start with a certification type process to be able to acknowledge that other factors were considered than just yield in the production of this product. Then you can pay a premium for that, or you can ask a premium for that, and then you get demand, and then you know, have the supply side that's going to build up to meet that demand. And so, yeah, I think that's a really important path to go down. Some way, somehow, a market-based solution.
Correct.
Thanks for joining us today on Streamlines. We sure had a lot of fun today. Hope you did, too. If you want to learn more about anything you heard today, head on over to the SDSU Extension website. But for now, I'm John McMain.
I'm Anthony Vly.
And we'll catch you next time.